today's birthdays include Tara L. Kaufman of Boone and Gloria Naylor of Manila. So we wish you both a very happy birthday. You're joined by some celebrities with an April 1st birthday. They include actor Ellie McGraw, actor Annette O'Toole, the singer Susan Boyle, Jessica Collins, who's also an actor, MSNBC television host and anchor Rachel Maddow has a birthday today, along with actor Sam Huntington, and some country singers, country singer Hillary Scott Terrell, who is known as Lady A, celebrates a birthday today, and actor Mackenzie Davis, as well as actor Asa Butterfield. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. There are not any obituaries in today's papers, so we will continue with some national news and international news. This piece about the war in Gaza. Hamas waiting for word of new offer from Israel. This is from Reuters News Service by Nidal El-Mughrabi. Israeli strikes killed 77 Palestinians in Gaza in the past 24 hours, health authorities said Sunday, as Egypt hosted an Israeli delegation for a new round of talks in a bid to secure a truce with Gaza's Hamas rulers. The Israeli military said it killed a senior Islamic Jihad militant in a strike on a command center in the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza. It did not mention his name or rank. The command center and terrorists were struck precisely, the military said, adding it was intended to minimize harm to uninvolved civilians in the area of the hospital. The Al-Aqsa Hospital building was not damaged, and its functioning was not affected. There was no immediate comment from Islamic Jihad, a militant group and ally of Hamas. Palestinian health officials said Hamas media said the strike hit several tents inside the Al-Aqsa Hospital, killing four people and wounding several, including five journalists. More than 32,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's military offensive in Gaza since October 7, 2023, according to health authorities. The war erupted after Hamas militants broke through the border and rampaged through communities in southern Israel, killing 1,200 people and abducting 253 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. The two sides have stepped up negotiations mediated by Qatar and Egypt on a six-week suspension of Israel's offensive in return for the proposed release of 40 of 130 hostages still held by Hamas militants in Gaza after their attack on southern Israel. Hamas says any deal must secure an end to the fighting and withdrawal of Israeli forces. Israel has ruled this out, saying it would eventually resume efforts to dismantle the governing and military capabilities of Hamas. Hamas would not be present at the talks in Cairo, an official told Reuters on Sunday, as it waited to hear from mediators on whether a new Israeli offer was on the table. In the southern Gaza Strip city of Khan Yunis, Israeli forces continued to blockade the two main hospitals and tanks shelled areas in the middle and eastern areas of the territory. Palestinian health officials said an Israeli airstrike killed nine people in Bani Suhaila near Khan Yunis, while another airstrike killed four people in Al-Maghazi camp in the central Gaza Strip. In Gaza City, Israeli forces continued to operate inside El Shifa Hospital, the territory's biggest. The health ministry said residents living nearby said residential districts had been destroyed by Israeli forces near El Shifa. I went out looking to buy some medicine from a pharmacy, and what I saw was heartbreaking, said Abu Mustafa, age 49. Complete streets with buildings that used to stand there had been destroyed. This is not war, this is genocide, he said by phone from Gaza City. Like the rest of the 2.3 million population of Gaza, Abu Mustafa, a father of six, is struggling to provide his family with food in the north of the enclave where the United Nations warned famine was imminent. We've had enough. We sleep and wake up dreaming of a ceasefire that will end the war and preserve the lives of whoever remains in Gaza, he said, refusing to give a name, fearing Israeli reprisals. At Gaza City's the Holy Family Church, some Christian Palestinians took part in a somber Easter service on Sunday. My wish is that they leave us alone and that we go back to our lands and children, said Winnie Taratzi, a Gaza woman praying at the church. Gaza's population comprises an estimated 1,000 Christians, most of whom are Greek Orthodox. The Israeli military said forces operating in El Shifa killed gunmen barricading the area and had found weapons. Several compounds used to launch anti-tank missiles and where snipers operated were struck by IAF aircraft in the Ramal neighborhood near Shifa, the military said. It added that forces killed 15 gunmen in central Gaza and several in Khan Yunis, including near El Amal Hospital. Israel said it killed and detained hundreds of Hamas and Islamic Jihad gunmen at El Shifa during a raid. Hamas and medical staff deny any armed presence inside medical facilities, accusing Israel of killing and arresting civilians. In the peace talks, Hamas also wants hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were displaced from Gaza City and surrounding areas southward during the first stage of the war to be allowed back north. The International Court of Justice on Thursday unanimously ordered Israel, accused by South Africa of genocide in Gaza, to take all necessary and effective action to ensure basic food supplies to the population.
Back here in the U.S., why are diabetes obesity drugs so pricey? A study raises questions about manufacturer profits from Karen Weinstrub of USA Today. New generation weight loss drugs can retail for about $1,350 a month, but a new study from Yale University suggests that they cost just $22 to make. Similarly, life-saving insulin can be manufactured for well under $250 a year, the study found, but it took pressure from the Biden administration to bring annual out-of-pocket costs for many Americans down to about $420. It's been nearly impossible to know how much it actually costs to get a dose from a laboratory bench into a patient's bloodstream. Now, a Yale postdoctoral researcher has provided rare transparency with some help from Doctors Without Borders, a global nonprofit that negotiates with drug companies and information with the pharmaceutical giant Sanofi, provided, perhaps by accident, to a Senate committee. Pulling back the curtain revealed the prices to be, quote, outrageous, said Senator Bernie Sanders, who released a statement shortly after the study published late Wednesday in the journal JAMA Network Open. He specifically called out the diabetes drug Ozempic, which has the same active ingredient as Wegovy, a weight loss drug. Both of them are made by Danish company Novo Nordisk. Sanders says Ozempic has the potential to be a game changer in the diabetes and obesity epidemics in America, but if we do not substantially reduce the price of this drug, millions who need it will be unable to afford it. Further, this outrageously high price has the potential to bankrupt Medicare, the American people, and our entire healthcare system. Sanders complained that Ozempic is available for $155 a month in Canada and just $59 in Germany, and called on the company to match the Canadian price here in the U.S. He said in a statement, "The American people are sick and tired of paying by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs while the pharmaceutical industry enjoys huge profits." Sanders noting that Novo Nordisk made nearly $15 billion in profits last year. He continued on and said, "A prescription drug is not safe or effective for a patient who can't afford it. Ozempic sells in the U.S. for over $900 a month. Wegovy, which was recently approved to reduce the risk of serious heart problems in people who are overweight, retails for about $1,350, although most people do pay far less than the list price. Eli Lilly makes two drugs in the same GLP-1 class of medications as the Novo Nordisk medications. Both Mounjaro for diabetes and Zepbound, which is the same medication for weight loss, retails for about $1,000. All four drugs have been in high demand and short supply since winning federal approval. Many private insurers, as well as Medicare and Medicaid, typically don't cover these drugs for weight loss and leaving them out of reach for significant numbers of people. The study found that Ozempic and Wegovy cost between 95 cents to $5.50 to produce per unit, or no more than $22 a month. Although the highest dose of Wegovy is higher than the full dose of Ozempic, the main driver is the cost of the delivery device. It's a needle embedded in a pen, according to Melissa Barber, who led that research. By Barber's calculations, if Medicare and Medicaid fully covered the cost of drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy for everyone who qualified, it would run taxpayers over $100 billion a year. Barber, who had been researching true manufacturing costs since 2016, said she's trying to introduce some transparency to an imbalanced system. She says that the system we have is companies can charge literally whatever they want. How much should we be paying attention to Novo Nordisk? There is a big difference between a multiplier of 10 and a multiplier of 10 billion, or 10 million rather. Novo Nordisk was reportedly founded to sell insulin and owned largely by a nonprofit, so it would plow its earnings back into research. The company now is Europe's most valuable, and its controlling shareholder charity is the largest in the world, Barber said. Frederick Banting, the Canadian credited with co-discovering insulin, sold the patent for a dollar because he thought the discovery belonged not to one person, but to the world. The real-world cost of insulin is often higher than it appears, though, and roughly 1 in 4 to 1 in 7 insulin-dependent Americans ration the drug because of price, Barber said. Synthetic insulin, the new study finds, can be made for about $11 for a box of 5 pens, including the cost of the needle and a 10% profit. For the current sale price is more than 5 times of that, Barber found. Novo Nordisk reduced the price of one form of insulin called Levemir, then announced it would discontinue the product in the U.S. So a year ago, Eli Lilly, which makes several types of insulin, capped out-of-pocket costs for that drug at $35 monthly at participating retail pharmacies for people with commercial insurance using Lilly insulin. Sanofi has said that the most of those who use its insulin products pay about $15 out-of-pocket per month, or about $180 a year, because of a copay assistance program. Novo Nordisk said it is doing what it can to make its new drugs more affordable and available. Novo Nordisk's media relations director, Jamie Bennett, said in a statement, "While we are unaware of the analysis used in this new study, we have always recognized the need for contributless evaluation and innovation and affordability levers to support for greater access of our products. We continue to support a greater health equity to those in need of diabetes treatment and care." Novo Nordisk does not disclose detailed information about costs, but Bennett said that 3/4 of its gross earnings go to rebates and discounts to ensure patients have access to products like semaglutide. Lilly referred in a statement to its commitment to improving access by 2030 to quality healthcare for 30 million people living with limited resources. The company also collaborates with EVA Pharma to provide for affordable insulin to 1 million people with diabetes in low and middle income countries, largely in Africa, as well as providing $4.3 billion in medicines last year to charitable organizations.
And in case you wondered, the king went to church on Easter Sunday. King Charles greets well-wishers. Britain's King Charles greeted well-wishers in an impromptu walkabout after an Easter church service in Windsor on Sunday, his first appearance at a public royal event since his cancer diagnosis was announced in February. A smiling Charles, age 75, accompanied by Queen Camilla, shook hands with scores of people outside St. George's Chapel, the resting place of his late mother, Queen Elizabeth. Charles had postponed all previous public engagements since Buckingham Palace announced he was to undergo treatment for an unspecified form of cancer. The illness was found in tests after he had a corrective procedure for an enlarged prostate in January. While the king attended church on Sunday, his son Prince William and his family did not. William's wife Kate said earlier this month she was undergoing preventative chemotherapy after cancer was discovered following abdominal surgery in January. The king, wearing a dark overcoat, and queen waved to onlookers when they arrived at the chapel by car from their residence at Windsor Castle. The queen was wearing a green coat dress and an emerald and diamond brooch that was the late queen's. Some of the onlookers wished Charles good health, while others said, "Happy Easter." The king said, "You're very brave to stand out here in the cold." A woman who spoke to the king said he seemed very well. Buckingham Palace has not confirmed any future public engagements for the king, but his eagerness to meet people on Sunday will be taken as a positive sign about his health. Also attending the annual service were the king's sister, the Princess Royal, and brother, the Duke of Edinburgh, accompanied by their spouses. The Duke of York, who was removed from royal duties in 2022 due to his friendship with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, was also present. Charles has kept up with the bulk of his non-public state duties, such as greeting foreign officials and holding regular meetings with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Last week, the king did not attend an annual Maundy Thursday service, but issued an audio message which aired at the event, in which he expressed his sorrow at not being there and wished the public a happy Easter.
And the last article in the main section of the Register: would bridge have been built same today? Modern structures often use styles that's different from the collapsed Baltimore span. This is from USA Today. Not many bridges can take a direct hit from a 95,000-ton ship without crumbling, engineers experts agree. But they also say Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, if it's built today, might have stood a better chance. Modern bridges don't look like the Key Bridge, which experts say lacked adequate defenses around its piers. Today's bridges have been designed to withstand a hit by a ship or have collision protection measures. Modern bridges also tend to be supported by larger pillars and cables, and they do come with layers of redundant design, which means that the loss of one support won't topple the whole bridge. The Key Bridge was never designed to withstand any lateral force that could have been possibly come from a ship, according to Sheriff Altawil, a professor engineer at the University of Michigan who studies hazard mitigation. They said the columns of an A-pier, one of them just snapped under this force, and the other one under the weight of the bridge just collapsed. That is why the bridge went down so quickly. Details surrounding the fall of the bridge remain sparse, and the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, has now launched an investigation. When the Singapore-flagged cargo ship Dolly lost power early Tuesday morning and collided with one of the bridge's support structures, it crumbled almost immediately. Federal authorities say at least six people are presumed dead as a result of this bridge collapse, and the economic fallout does continue from the closure of that port of Baltimore. Altawil and other bridge safety experts say more modern bridge designs like cable, stayed, or suspension models would have larger, better protected piers for their supports. They say these changes were spurred by a similar tragedy, the 1980 collapse of the Florida Sunshine Skyway Bridge, which crossed Tampa Bay. In that case, a ship collided with one of the bridge's support structures, triggering that collapse and killed 35 people. The new Sunshine Skyway Bridge now has rock islands surrounding the bridge supports, in addition to several, quote, dolphins. Essentially, it's steel and concrete barriers that sit in the water, and they are meant to deter boats. In some cases, massive bridges might be able to withstand the force of a boat's impact by virtue of their simply being bigger than the vessel that's colliding with them. This is written by Kent Harries, a structural engineering professor at the University of Pittsburgh. He cited the Forth Bridge, a rail bridge in Scotland that stretches about a mile and a half, and it was constructed with 53,000 tons of steel. But distance between boats and bridges is often the best defense, Harris says. He wrote, "Fundamentally, I'm unaware of many bridges that mitigate the risk of very large vessel collision by brute force. Instead, most bridge designs isolate in some way shore islands, protective shallows of the piers." Baltimore's Key Bridge, built in the 1970s, was what's called a truss-style bridge. Trusses are usually triangular structures that interlock and support the bridge. They were among the most common types of long-distance bridges that's built in America for much of the mid-20th century before going out of vogue in 1980s. Benjamin Schaefer, a professor of civil and systems engineering at Johns Hopkins University, said they have fallen out of fashion for both aesthetic and practical reasons. Germany had many of the world's notable truss bridges, but they were destroyed during World War II. When the country started rebuilding, Schaefer said it made a deliberate decision not to rebuild truss bridges because they didn't want to rebuild Germany to look like Germany. Enter cable-style bridges. These structures are recognizable by a central pillar with cables stretching downward to support the bridge. Initially, Schaefer says they were more expensive to construct, but over time, building methods did improve. The first cabled state bridge in America is the Florida Sunshine Skyway Bridge. Cable state bridges require fewer parts, and they are easier to build than truss bridges. With its multiple cables, if one goes out, the bridge is not likely to fail because there are others. Assuming the Key Bridge is rebuilt, it will likely be a cable, stayed, or suspension bridge, often the preferred structures for an intermediate length. Suspension bridges, held up by strong cables stretching from the high towers at each, are still the preferred way for longer spans. Shorter stretches might be served by arch or truss-style bridges. Building bridges is a colossal undertaking, though, and structures that still serve their purpose are unlikely to be replaced. The experts interviewed by USA Today cautioned that the collision was an extraordinary event, and there's only so much to be done to make bridges safer than they already are. Now, before it was struck, there were no signs that the Key Bridge was in danger of falling. A May 2023 inspection report on file with the Federal Highway Administration listed the structure in overall fair condition. There is a great deal of pearl clutching going on, an expectation that all must be fail-safe. This is not possible, Harry said. The analogy I offer is that pedestrian sidewalks are mostly adjacent to vehicle carriageways, and few have more protection than a short curb. Now, as a pedestrian, I have an implicit faith that the cars will stay in their lanes and not jump the curb. There is also a limit to what bridges can be expected to survive, especially in an era when cargo ships have grown larger. Stephen E. Flynn, a professor of political science and expert in critical infrastructure and supply chain and resilience at Northeastern University, said that while not every bridge in the country needs massive safety upgrades, those that serve major ports would benefit from modern protections. Flynn ended by saying, "I hope as a recommendation coming out of this that we look at each one."
As we're drawing close to our break time, some of the short articles in the In Brief section of USA Today. No winner for Powerball lottery. Jackpot jumps to $975 million. A $935 million jackpot in the Powerball lottery draw, one of the largest in its history, found no winners on Saturday night, boosting the prize for next week's draw. No one held the winning numbers, which were 12, 13, 33, 50, 52, and the Powerball 23, the website showed. The next drawing will take place on Monday, today, with the estimated jackpot now rising to $975 million. The prize, now the fifth largest in the history of the game, according to lottery officials, has been growing steadily since the last Powerball winner hit the jackpot on New Year's Day of 2024. If there is a single winner on Monday, the ticket holder can choose to accept the money in a single lump sum with the prize carrying a cash value of about $471.7 million, lottery officials said. To secure the prize, the winner or winners must beat a one in $292.2 million chance, $292.2 million chance, and match the correct six numbers on a $2 ticket. Powerball tickets are sold in 45 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The purse at stake on Saturday was still below the $1.13 billion jackpot won this week in a drawing by another lottery, Mega Millions, and well below the largest single lottery prize total in U.S. history. That came in November 2022, when a lone ticket holder in California won a $2.04 billion Powerball jackpot. And this from Jakarta in Indonesia. Bima Abdul Shola, age 32, sat calmly as a doctor armed with a laser pointer zapped tattoos from his face at an event in Jakarta being held by a charity organization during the holy month of Ramadan to give practicing Muslims an opportunity to repent. Like him, more than 100 Indonesians have signed up for tattoo removal procedures being conducted for free by the Amil Zakat National Agency, an Islamic charity organization during Ramadan. Ramadan is the perfect momentum for this program. To erase the tattoos is a form of worship to Allah, said Raja Zamzami, the coordinator of the event, which is in its fourth year. These people realize they want to repent, leave their past lifestyles and mistakes. Tattoos are considered forbidden in Islam as physical mutilation of the skin. While many of Indonesia's 220 million Muslims, predominantly Sunnis, practice a more moderate form of Islam, tattoos are still seen in a negative light due to the association with rough street lifestyles. Bima is removing tattoos from his body and face after leaving behind his former life, details on which he preferred to keep private. Neela Novian, age 24, who was having a small tattoo of an initial in silver on her forearm removed, said for her erasing it was more about avoiding stigma. And those short articles are from Reuters News Institute. For the last 90 minutes, your readers today have been Nicole Tam, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. It's been our pleasure to read for you, and now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. We'll now continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Carol with our first opinion piece.
Thank you, Jeff. This is entitled, "Despite Son's Death, We Will Still Fight for Hostages," by Ruby Chen. Earlier this year, I wrote about the moment I learned my son was taken hostage. Last October, a few days after Hamas's murderous rampage through Israel, a group of Israeli officers stood at my doorstep. My 19-year-old son, Itay Chen, was taken captive while serving at the Gaza border. He was in the hands of terrorists who murdered, mutilated, and raped hundreds of Israelis, but he was believed to be alive as there was no evidence to prove the alternative. So there was reason for hope. For 5 months we lived off that hope. The hostage families established a nonprofit organization to coordinate all the hostage families' efforts for 241 families from more than 40 nationalities, and I joined its executive steering committee. I have met presidents, chancellors, and ambassadors, visited Qatar, Germany, and of course, Washington, D.C., to try to influence the decision makers so that the next time an official showed up at my door, it would be cause for celebration, cause because my son was coming home. Unfortunately, I was wrong. On March 11th, the Israel Defense Forces and U.S. officials came back with new intelligence. My son was among the more than 40 American citizens murdered on October 7th, and Hamas savages took his remains, apparently to use as future bargaining chip. Hamas seems to have taken a page out of the Islamic State terrorist organization's strategy to take dead hostages, while not notifying the Red Cross he was killed, to increase the psychological pain of his parents and the Israeli and U.S. people. I thought my wife and I would never suffer pain greater than learning our son was a hostage. That now feels like a passing twinge in comparison with the agony that consumes us today and will for the rest of our lives. But we refuse to let the pain paralyze us. We won't start Shiva until our son's remains return for burial. According to the Jewish tradition, when a family is notified of a deceased family member, it should hold a Shiva, a week of mourning and prayer for the deceased, and start a new chapter in life. Instinctively, upon notice, I told Israeli and U.S. officials that we will not start the Shiva until Itay's remains are returned to Israel for burial as the hero that he is. This is the same message I shared with President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and numerous senators and congressmen who called to share their condolences. It is my daily reminder to them that my mission as a father is not done until Itay is back home, and I remind all elected officials to pressure Hamas in any way possible to get a deal done. It would have been humane to leave Itay's body behind, but Hamas terrorists deprived my family of even the smallest mercy, the chance to bury Itay and mourn over his body. These terrorists are like ISIS and are the worst of humanity, and this requires all of us to unite to defeat this darkness. The hostage crisis is not a political issue and should stay a bipartisan cause, despite the temptation of the election year. The hostage families felt the respect and unity during the State of the Union address when the president acknowledged us in the audience, and we received only bipartisan standing ovation of the evening. We urge both U.S. Congress and our Israeli Prime Minister against
turning our family members into a topic for political gain. Ramadan prayer and charity. Finally, we would also like to reach out to the U.S. Muslim community and wish them a Ramadan Kareem, which is a month of prayer and charity between one another. We hope that U.S.-based Muslim religious leaders will denounce the Hamas actions and remember that Islamic laws demand respect for the sacred bodies of the deceased of any region, religion. We will continue to fight harder than ever before until Aite and all hostages are released from captivity and reunited with their families. Jeff?
Global security is at risk without Ukraine aid. This opinion piece by John P. Walters, an opinion contributor who Walters is president and CEO of Hudson Institute. He writes, after months of contentious debate, the House of Representatives is nearing a vote on aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The military assistance to Ukraine is the most urgent matter, and it is the point of greatest disagreement. Two questions will be decisive. Why should the United States continue to support Ukraine? And is there a plan to defeat Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion? This month, experts from Washington's Hudson Institute traveled to Kyiv and Odessa. We found that American support for Ukraine is more important than ever. Ukraine's resolve, innovation, and battlefield successes make clear that supporting their plan for the months ahead is in the best interests of the United States. Ukraine's leaders have a plan for victory. It begins with isolating and weakening Russia. Ukrainian forces have done much more than merely fend off conquest. They've taken back half the territory seized during the initial invasion, have destroyed approximately one-third of Russia's Black Sea fleet despite possessing no navy, and have waged a systematic campaign of attrition against the Russian aerospace forces. What Ukraine has achieved against Russian invaders. If past is prologue, then Russian forces are in for a bloody year. Without a single U.S. or NATO soldier firing a shot, Russia has suffered losses of manpower and equipment it has not seen since World War II. By one estimate, we heard in Kyiv, Russian casualties may have eclipsed 500,000 men. Many Russian units have been shattered, including special elite troops, and in 2 years, Ukraine has killed more high-ranking Russian general officers than were killed over the decade-long wars in Afghanistan and Syria. Ukraine also plans to counter Russians' reliance on attritional warfare. Ukraine is pioneering disruptive battlefield technologies and fielding them at scale. This year, Kyiv will produce 1 million killer drones. Ukraine also now possesses the ability to attack vital Russian positions on NATO's doorstep, like occupied Crimea, and threaten Russian troops elsewhere, as in Transnistria, the Russian-backed enclave in Moldova. Ukraine's offensive capability opens a path to end the war on terms favorable to Ukraine. Yet, this success depends on protecting Ukraine's population and infrastructure from long-range Russian strikes, protection that available U.S. and NATO weapons systems can easily provide at minimal cost to the West. Restocking Kyiv's arsenal of Patriot missiles and other air defense systems, augmenting its long-range strike options, and topping up its supply of traditional artillery rounds and mortars will help repel Russian attacks. The United Kingdom's Storm Shadow air-launched cruise missile and its French Scalp counterpart are especially effective against high-value targets, and the German Taurus system would enhance the power of the F-16 fighter aircraft that Ukraine will operate later this year. Crucially, the U.S. Army Tactical Missile System, that is the ATACMS, possesses the range to threaten Russian forces. Critics of providing Ukraine with these advanced weapons argue that doing so leaves Taiwan vulnerable to Beijing's predations. They're correct that China is intent on subjugating Taiwan. In his latest annual report to the National People's Congress, Chinese Premier Li Qiang intentionally omitted the word peaceful when advocating for reunification of the two polities. Yet, critics of aiding Ukraine fail to note that the enemies of America and its allies have united. China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea have created an alliance. They share munitions, supplies, technology, and financial tools, while coordinating military and diplomatic strategies worldwide. With support from Beijing, Tehran, and Pyongyang, Moscow is not just attacking Ukraine, it's threatening the entire free world. Beijing, Moscow, Iran, North Korea axis wants to weaken the free world. This is why, despite volumes of misinformation suggesting otherwise, our European allies have given more per capita to Ukraine than the United States has contributed. These allies provide Washington with the economic and military power necessary to match China and Russia. The Beijing, Moscow, Iran, North Korea axis wants to weaken Europe to divide democracies and take them on as disunited and weak. Despite the many frustrations inherent in a partnership for free people, the transatlantic alliance makes the United States stronger, and our adversaries know it. Ukraine is the strategic hinge of Europe, where the battle for the future of Europe and the Indo-Pacific is unfolding. Declining to fight that battle out of fear of provoking a Russian response runs counter to U.S. security and the alliances that give America the power to protect itself with its allies. Supplying Ukraine with weapons like the ATACMS doesn't just help Ukraine. It also puts the United States in a position to deter our adversaries. China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea want nothing more than to build a world order that they will control. Providing Ukraine with the means to pursue victory is a crucial step in ensuring they will fail. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And that concludes opinions. For today, we'll move on to sports, starting with sports on TV that you can watch or listen to for Monday, April 1st. Hey, it's April Fool's Day. These times are all current for our central region. First is for hockey, NHL, at 8 p.m. on ESPN Plus/Hulu. It's Edmonton at St. Louis. For basketball, this is NBA at 7 p.m. NBA TV. Phoenix is at New Orleans. For women's college basketball, at 1:30 p.m., it's ESPNU, Penn State versus Villanova. And then another game at 4 p.m., ESPNU, it's Illinois versus Washington State. At 6 p.m. it's on ESPN, it's LSU versus Iowa. Iowa, yay. 6 p.m., Big Plus, Vermont at Purdue. And at 8 p.m. tonight, ESPN, it's UConn versus USC. And then we moved to baseball. MLB at 1:20 p.m. on MLBN, Colorado is playing at Chicago Cubs. A 5:50 p.m. FS1, Texas is at Tampa Bay. And at 8:40 p.m. MLBN at 8:40, New York Yankees at Arizona. And our final one is for MLBN at 9:10 p.m. It's San Francisco at the L.A. Dodgers. And now we'll go back to Jeff.
In college women's basketball, of course, the game that everyone's talking about, LSU Buildup, offers a chance for Iowa to display mental maturity. The NCAA tournament was going to provide opportunity in one form or another, highly visible chances for Iowa women's basketball to showcase all that's been obtained during this remarkable ride. After months and months of relentless attention that created distractions seemingly out of nowhere, it would have felt like wasted effort any other way. Sure, the March Madness spotlight was going to shine brightly on Caitlin Clark and Iowa, no matter which foe settled in on the other side. But to get Monday's matchup and everything that comes with facing LSU again, it feels like the ultimate test of honing in on what matters and eliminating what doesn't. We don't really care about what the outsiders have to say, 60-year guard Kate Martin said. They're not in this locker room with us every day. They're not here handling our business that we do every single day. Obviously, everyone was looking forward to this matchup, I'm sure. But we are too, and we want to play anybody. It doesn't matter who the other team is. We're just going to handle our business how we do. Just stay mission-focused. By now, the discourse that followed last season's national title game needs a little refreshing. With Clark and LSU's Angel Reese at the center of it all, the Tigers' 102-85 win over the Hawkeyes in Dallas quickly acquired more toxic elements well beyond just basketball. Seemingly tame discussions gave way to harmful conversations full of sexist and racial undertones that framed a basketball game to be anything but only that. Every negative element of social media gravitated to the front, with both fan bases contributing to the noise. When the final buzzer sounded on Iowa's Sweet 16 win Saturday over Colorado, roughly 48 hours stood between then and Monday's 6 p.m. Elite Eight tip against LSU. 2 days might as well be 10 years on social media, where anyone and everyone can chime in to create a relentless avalanche of distractions that spares nobody. Famous athletes like Clark and Reese can log on to this platform or that the same way those who cheer and rip them do. A disciplined team-wide effort is the only way to completely avoid it all. Before any personal concern or in-game adjustment, that is Iowa's initial challenge. Gabby Marshall said, "We're mature enough to know to stay off social media and not really feed into all that stuff that's going to come up just because it's a rematch game. You get those every year. You lose and you play the team you lose to again. That's nothing new. It happens a lot in basketball. I think it's just the outside things, non-basketball related, that people will focus on. Try to stir the pot a little bit. But I think we're mature enough to stay within our circle and not worry about those things and prepare the same way we always have." While limiting distractions, particularly at this stage of the season, is a rallying cry for many teams still playing, the Hawkeyes know firsthand it's no throwaway cliche. 5-plus months as arguably the most visible program in women's basketball, with a superstar who has become a magnet for criticism through no fault of her own, has handed Iowa one obstacle after another it didn't ask for. Take your pick. Clark's multi-layered scoring chase that negatively expanded way beyond basketball. Her skyrocketing fame that now includes FaceTime all over commercials and advertisements. Unprompted social media shots from multiple big basketball names. The Ohio State post-game collision, and much more. All of it arrived with Iowa shouldering and meeting on-court expectations that once seemed insane. Clark has had to shut out the most of anyone, but it's truly been a black and gold attempt to keep, as Marshall put it, the main thing is the main thing. Iowa's results to this point indicate the effort has been largely successful. A program record 32 wins with a number one NCAA tournament seed. While watching Clark somehow find another step to take when it seemed her prowess was already maximized, it offers ample evidence that this mental task can be conquered like the rest of them. "We've done it all year long. Why quit now?" Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. "We've just put blinders on. We've completely prepared for every opponent as if it was the national championship game. We're not going to start listening to outside noise now. Keep the earmuffs on." By the time Iowa arrived at MVP Arena on Sunday morning for media obligations, more than a quarter of this 48-hour challenge had been completed. All the right answers were said in front of the mic, unsurprising given how much high-end media experience this group has racked up. The Hawkeyes have seen how wild narratives can run when even a perceived slip-up unfolds. Clark and Iowa won't meet with the media again until post-game Monday night, but that's hardly the most crucial setting where distractions must be avoided. It's the downtime in the hotel, the empty gaps in the itinerary, the moments while trying to fall asleep that can be most detrimental between now and tip-off Monday night. Speaking Sunday about handling exactly that, Bluter emphasized that culture can't suddenly emerge when the bullets are flying. That in the moment is too late to instill the correct way to handle things. Those values and approaches must be hammered home long before adversity appears. While the Hawkeyes didn't know exactly how their year-long experiences would be tested in the NCAA tournament, the fact it's LSU and all the strings attached shouldn't be an overwhelming endeavor. "You can't worry about the outside noise," Clark said. "And if we did worry about the outside noise, we wouldn't be in this position right now." Carol?
Dear Abby, my husband and I have been friends with another couple for many years, and when the house across the street from ours became available, they bought it. Not long after they moved in, the wife began to copy our interior and exterior design elements, and one night stood in our kitchen and said, "Well, you know, everything's a competition." To say you were dismayed would be an understatement. My husband and I spent many years collecting vintage furniture and other items to create a distinctive home. 6 months ago, we installed a unique garage door, unlike anything in the neighborhood. Abby, within 3 months, she installed the same exact one. We no longer want to spend time with them, but don't want to completely sever the connection because they are neighbors, and we also have some mutual friends. Moving is not an option. This is our home. What should we do? Signed, Fed Up in Ohio. Abby says, "Dear Fed Up, I understand why you're frosted and need to distance yourself. Who wants to be close to someone who considers everything to be a competition? Perhaps it will lessen your frustration to remember that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, while you learn to accept things that you cannot change. Of course, it is in your best interest to keep things cordial, but it might be better if you no longer invite this woman into your home." Dear Abby, I lost my beautiful mother 6 years ago. While, of course, I miss her terribly, something else has been bothering me that I'm having trouble getting over. I allowed my cousin on my dad's side of the family to come to the hospital with me to see her and pay her respects, which didn't bother me. It's what occurred next that I have the big issue with. When my cousin left the hospital, she jumped straight on Facebook and posted for everyone to see, "Rest in peace, Aunt Sally." Everyone who was friends with Mom saw the post, which meant she announced my mom's passing before I even had time to process it all. I was extremely hurt, angry, sad, and shocked that she would do that. It still bothers me, as it's not something that can be undone. I was still lying beside my mom crying and trying to say goodbye to her when my phone started blowing up with messages and notifications. How can I get past the betrayal I feel? I have had very little contact with that cousin since. Signed, Hurt in Florida. Abby says, "Dear Hurt, your cousin may have been venting rather than intending to make a formal announcement of your mother's passing. The problem with posting is that once it's on there, it is out there for everyone to see and react to. I do think this is something you should discuss with your cousin, who may not have realized how her online sentiments affected you on that sad and stressful day. You deserve an apology for her insensitivity." And here's Jeff.
Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. Earlier, you heard from Nicole Tam and Rachel Mithelman. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.